Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, what happens when a courageous physician with two board certifications, an impeccable career, spending decades at one of the most prestigious hospitals in America, starts treating patients, outpatients, for COVID. Over 2,000, they all get better. They all reclaim their health. Not one single hospitalization, not one single death. And she's attacked for it. Well, we're going to hear from her. Dr. Mary Bowden, in just a moment. Dr. Mary Bowden, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Just a little background, because I'm not aware, looking into your background, that you've had any major controversial issues in the past. You've just been a mainstream, orthodox, board-certified physician with a background in internal medicine, specializing in sleep medicine, allergies, and also holistic wellness. You were also the founder of BreathMD in Houston, Texas. Well, last November, you had your medical privileges suspended by the prestigious Houston Methodist Hospital, followed by your resignation, on the grounds of stating that you were giving misinformation on your position advocating early treatment against the SARS-2 infections, as well as your criticism of some of the vaccine mandates. This was despite your having treated over 2,000 COVID-19 patients with ivermectin, monoclonal antibodies, and a whole host of other medications, FDA-approved, off-label, as well as nutrients that are known in the peer-reviewed literature to help people. And by the way, none of your patients required hospitalization. In and of itself, treating 2,000 COVID patients, and I'm assuming most were not just COVID positive, but asymptomatic. I'm sure many of them had different types of symptoms. But now you're one of the only doctors providing early treatment in the United States, its fourth largest city, focusing on unvaccinated patients through your private clinic. You've also testified along with Dr. Peter McCullough and Dr. Robert Malone before congressional committees hosted by Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, and good for him. You also are a graduate of the University of North Carolina. You received your medical degree summa cum laude from the Medical College of Georgia. You later continued your studies at the Stanford University Medical Center, very prestigious, and your website is breathemd.org. So that just lets our audience know that you're not someone who is not qualified to speak on how to treat a patient, especially a patient manifesting symptoms at the beginning of a condition that could ultimately, if not treated, end them up in a hospital on ventilation or dead. That said, we played a video clip of you last week that went viral, and where you gave a press conference following your departure from the Houston Methodist Hospital. And so I do not want to focus on that experience at the moment. However, I would like to know what kind of support or lack of support or even criticisms you received from your medical colleagues, the people that you had no problems with for all the time you were there. You worked together and frequently collaboratively. Were they supportive of you, more or less, or quiet? Or were they in any way negative against you? And what is the overall atmosphere in hospitals and clinics now, since you're in communication with a lot of other doctors in your place, concerning how they go about trying to help people with COVID? And lastly, I give a large opening introduction so you can take your time and unfold all this. What are you and your colleagues communicating about how to help patients that can also be confirmed by the medical literature? So if you are challenged by one of the people on television saying, well, she's just dispensing misinformation, which is costing people their health and possibly their life, and then you're attacked, can you come back and say, hold on, the FDA allows and actually encourages clinical experience, what we doctors do, to be a part of the official commentary on how to treat these situations, and here's the science I have to support my position, Could you take us through those, please? The form is yours.
Thank you so much, Gary. So in terms of the reaction from the established medical community, mostly quiet, but online, not so quiet. I was on a couple of online forums. There's a pretty well-known one called, it's PMG, which stands for Physician Mom Groups. And I'm not sure how many members they have, but most doctors know about it. It's an online forum on Facebook. And I posted on there that I was looking to hire a primary care physician who was not vaccinated. And they just wiped me off the slate of their board immediately. Then there's an online Facebook forum for Houston women's physicians. And they, instead of just, you know, quietly censoring me, really attacked me, just saying pretty vicious things, you know, that it's funny because I don't think a bunch of men would do the same thing to each other, but very petty and name calling and hurtful things to me online. And eventually they, after beating me up, then they kicked me to the curb and shut me off their little forum. So I'm actually an ear, nose, and throat and sleep medicine specialist. I'm double board certified. And there's a online forum for the American Academy of Otolaryngology that is a national forum where I was very active on that. I loved it because it was a great way to collaborate and, you know, ask questions if you had a difficult patient or if you had a, you know, business question or anything. It was wonderful. And I didn't even bring up the whole controversy, but one of my supporters brought it up, and I said, what's happening out there is frightening. And that's all I said. And I was kicked off. So that part has been very hurtful. But on the upside, I have found so many new supporters in the medical community. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with what signal channels are, but it's sort of a private way of texting, of doing group chatting. And I'm on several physician-only signal channels and collaborate with them on a daily basis. I just love it. There's all this back and forth about what they're seeing and how they're treating patients. And there's a lot of exchange of scientific data. And I get a lot of my data from that. I am on there's something called PubMed, which I think most people now are familiar with. It's a source for published peer review articles. So I'm on that a lot, looking for information. But I would say the most important source of information I have is just collaborating with people who are on the front line and seeing what they're doing, what's working, what's not, because there's so much changing, shifting information. And, you know, peer review studies are important, but they're a starting point and they're not as important as actually treating patients. And I'm in a unique situation because my practice has progressed. I started off when early on in the pandemic, when testing was hard to come by, the labs were overwhelmed, supplies were limited, and the government started rationing who could get tested. I was able to find a way around that, and I partnered with a lab that was able to provide saliva testing, which did not require any special equipment. It was contact-free. And so I was able to provide access to testing for my patients, and that sort of thrust me into becoming a COVID testing center. And then I started hearing from my patients that their primary care doctors were unwilling to see them when they were sick, and they were told to stay home and do nothing and only go to the emergency room or seek healthcare treatment when they were having difficulty breathing. And that did not sit well with me. And in response, I started researching treatment options and began offering breathing treatments. I would have patients stay in their car, and I would bring the nebulizer out to their car and give them breathing treatments And then eventually I started using ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, vitamins, and really sort of aligned myself with the frontline critical care doctors. I'm now a clinical advisor on their team. And then monoclonal antibodies, I also administered monoclonal antibodies for a while until my supplies were shut off from the government. So now my practice is evolved even further, and then I have patients saying they're unwilling to go to the hospital because they're scared of what might happen if they do. So I have patients coming to me and receiving the medications that they should be receiving in the hospitals and actually doing quite well. It's very encouraging and amazing. Prior to the pandemic, I never would have guessed that I could help somebody who came into my clinic with an oxygen level of 82% get better as an outpatient. That would have been immediate admission to the hospital. They probably would get intubated right away. And what I'm seeing is you can treat those patients with IV steroids, IV vitamins. Sometimes I do IV antibiotics, depending on what's going on. And I have them come in every day, as an outpatient, and they're doing great, which is very encouraging. And it's a real mark of progress in healthcare, I think, is that not everybody with low oxygen level needs to be intubated. We call it permissive hypoxemia, where you let people, if they're able to tolerate lower oxygen levels, let them stay at that level because it's better than intubating them. Because once they're intubated, their chances of survival are 25% or less.
I want to follow up on something you just said, please. I'm sure you had a stellar medical career before the pandemic. I don't want to ask whether before you took your stance about ivermectin and the other medications and supplements you were using and vaccinations in general, whether you had reviewed the actual scientific peer review literature and to see, was there a legitimate basis for using any one of these supplements or drugs? And because most of the time, and the reason for that is when we were speaking with physicians, lots of physicians, we found they had done zero research, none. And that's what I do all the time. We have hundreds of thousands of studies off PubMed reviewed over the years. And I wrote a paper on, this goes back to the beginning, the very beginning of the crisis, saying until such time that the treatments that we know will help, why not use what the peer-reviewed PubMed literature shows will help against SARS viruses in general, vitamin D and vitamin C, quercetin, black cumin seed oil, et cetera. There were about 22 different nutrients. And all told, there were over 2,000 studies just on those. Yet no one in the media, no one in the medical community, no one in the scientific community was looking at the actual literature that we had at hand that we could have started people. And it also would have helped strengthen the body's natural immune system, because virtually all the literature shows the stronger your immune system, the less likely you are to A, become infected or seriously decline in health once infected. You're far more likely to survive. In fact, those who are vitamin D deficient have a very high rate of not surviving COVID, especially if they have comorbidities. But nobody was looking at this. What was your position on this? When did you finally become aware of ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, and even the what you mentioned you use, which was the monoclonal antibodies and steroids?
Right. That I remember the first time somebody suggested ivermectin. It was actually my brother-in-law, and I was so busy. I mean, things were just chaotic. I mean, we never closed our clinic. We're open 7 days a week, and while everybody else was at home, I was just working. And I remember my brother-in-law said, "Hey, what about ivermectin?" And I kind of thought, "What? That just sounds..." I was skeptical. But then more and more buzz around ivermectin. And the first thing I did is I went to the FDA's website and I went to the original study where ivermectin was approved by the FDA, because I was worried about safety. I'm like, okay, maybe it doesn't work, maybe it does, but I want to make sure that I'm not going to hurt somebody by giving this medication. So I went to the original FDA trial, a clinical trial where they showed the safety data of ivermectin, and that convinced me that it was safe. And I also went on PubMed and I tried to find any kind of literature showing that people have died from ivermectin. And again, it was, I think I found one study, and it was somebody that took massive amounts. And it to me, it sounded like it would be hard to kill yourself with ivermectin if you wanted to. So once I had the safety information underhand, I was willing to try it, even if there's conflicting evidence in PubMed or in the literature about ivermectin, because there's a lot of conflicting data in the literature about everything. It's hard for there to be a consensus. And with the pandemic evolving and changing, and my view was, let's try it. And, you know, if it's not going to hurt anybody, let's try it. And then I'll see for myself. And then what happened is I had confirmation from my patients telling me how well it was working. I remember I had a friend of mine sent some ivermectin to her brother. I prescribed it. She got it to her brother. He was in the hospital. He was about to go to the ICU. She snuck the ivermectin in a Q-tip box. And the next day he was discharged. He felt so much better. So I keep hearing things like that. And I know that it's not going to hurt anybody. Coupled with all, there is, you know, not 100, I think, I can't remember, 90 something peer reviewed studies supporting the use of ivermectin. That was enough for me. The monoclonal antibodies, I was a little bit worried because it's a new drug coming out in the midst of a pandemic. I'm always a little skeptical about new drugs when they first come out. But the monoclonal antibody technology had been around enough, and I decided to use it. And what I found is majority of people made a quick turnaround in 24 to 48 hours. It was pretty astounding. And it's a shame that we can't I can't get my hands on anymore. That's just needs to be highlighted more in the media, why that is such an issue, because it really does do the trick for a lot of people pretty dramatically. And then the IV, the vitamins, yes. I mean, there is, like you said, there is, I remember one of the things I looked into, there was a study that came out from University of Washington about the benefit of lactoferrin. And at that time, I was like, I'm not even sure what lactoferrin is. And it comes from colostrum, the best breast milk. And I remember going back and looking at all the data in the literature. I'm like, wow, there is a lot of supporting evidence in the literature about using lactoferrin, and yet nobody's talking about it. And it's true, if you go back and look at all the vitamins, and especially vitamin D, I mean, that's a wonderful breakthrough that I think has brought, the COVID pandemic has brought to light, is the importance of vitamin D in your immunity and checking your vitamin D level and having a range, an appropriate range to have your level at to optimize your health.
Good. Thank you. One of the problems I'm having and have had all along is the bias within the mainstream media. It made no sense. I'm also a journalist and have reported broken a lot of stories. And there was a time when you could actually break a story and have the media cover it. 60 Minutes covered one of mine. 2020 covered one. Won two Emmys on that. Today, nothing. Absolutely nothing that interferes in the official protocols of medicine can be exposed. So when I looked at the original stories on ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine and the people promoting their use, these were respected scientists. These people had outstanding credentials and backgrounds. Excuse me. None of them ever had any controversy. 20, 30, 40-year careers. Now suddenly they're being attacked. It's one thing to say, let us have an open, civil discussion where you agree or disagree on something. It's another thing to say, for the mere fact that you're bringing information that we consider as disinformation, you do not deserve to be a physician any longer. So the state medical boards began to send warnings out, as you know, by using ivermectin. And then they stopped the administration, stopped the use of monoclonal antibodies, even though the evidence was overwhelming that it was saving lives. an early intervention with other medications was overwhelming that it was saving lives. So when you have all the media, and I mean all the media, from PBS and NPR, Rachel Maddow, and the people on the left and right, all saying the same thing, that this is all disinformation, but they're using the same identical words. And so when I see the same words used by the BBC or the Canadian Broadcasting Company or someone else, you can't have thousands of journalists and reporters all using the same identical words unless someone gave them those words. These are talking points. This is a propaganda campaign in full force. And the only ones exposing this were the people who themselves had been a part of the establishment. Matt Taibbi, Glenn Greenwald, Max Blumenthal, Chris Hedges, Abby Martin, etc. So these people, Naomi Wolf, these are the people who no longer are allowed to be published anywhere. They've been deplatformed. Wikipedia's, you know, attacked all of them. So then I start to think, since when did we take medicine and politicize it and weaponize it to this degree? I would have thought of the 800,000 plus physicians in the United States alone, this would have been a wake-up call, clarion moment. It was not. Of all the scientists in the United States and around the world, I thought they will see that this is being mishandled. There's too many inconsistencies. There's just, you could drive a truck through all of the things that didn't make any sense. For example, how is it in 1 year you could have anywhere from 30 to 70,000 people dying of the flu in the United States, and the next year, 2020, none. In 2021, none. That's not humanly possible. So then the obvious thing is, are they classifying COVID cases or vaccine, flu with COVID? And then all the other inconsistencies. So when you put it all together, you put the pieces together, you see that, my God, none of this makes sense. So then they wrote from the professor from Harvard, professor from Stanford, professor from Oxford, wrote the Great Barrington Declaration, which now I think has over 80,000 medical doctors and scientists alone and hundreds of thousands of others who have signed it. I was one of the signers, and I'm sure you're familiar with it if you haven't signed it already. All of those people were attacked. I mean, in total, how do you attack tens of thousands of scientists and physicians who are all orthodox, all pro-vaccine, many have taken the vaccine, and say they're all charlatans, they're quacks, they're disinformation people? How do you do that unless there's a coordinated program behind the scenes of people that we probably have never heard of who own corporations that profit from all this? But nobody was asking the media, who profits from COVID? Mm-hmm. And had they done that, then this would have stopped being a pandemic and just been an intense flu season problem from the beginning. But now they can't say they made a mistake. The consequences to their careers, their corporations, would be so great that they would be inundated. There'd be trillion-dollar lawsuits because we've had trillions of dollars of loss, careers lost, lives lost. Wrongful deaths would happen. So when you look at everything now, sitting back from your current position, go through, please, take your time, go through the inconsistencies, the contradictions in both public health science and medicine and medical treatment that you see that shows how much everyone who's involved in this has failed the American public and the world public on this issue.
Right. There's a lot to be said on this. One thing that's very obvious is the role of natural immunity and how that has not been recognized. It's starting to be recognized, but why do we need a shot for an illness that we're just getting over? I mean, the fact that they're pushing people to get a quote unquote vaccine 2 weeks after you've recovered from COVID makes absolutely no sense. You wouldn't tell somebody to get the flu shot 2 weeks after recovering from the flu. The other thing is giving these vaccines to children when their risk of dying from COVID is essentially zero, and when there's so many adverse reactions being reported, Why would you give something to a child that could potentially hurt them and not help them? I think there's the other thing that is being neglected in all this is the risk factors, and it's true with any disease. Obesity is the most dangerous health problem we have out there. It doesn't matter if it's COVID or any other disease, but obesity is the biggest risk factor for the most common diseases that take Americans down. And why is that not being talked about by anybody? I mean, obviously it's hard to tell somebody you can't, you know, go lose 30 pounds and you won't get sick. But if we had that in the radar, as much as we had vaccines on the radar, we could do a lot of good for our population. So those are the three that come to mind. But the testing also, you're right. It's like the flu. Where did the flu go? And we do test for flu at my clinic. And strangely, we did not see a lot of flu tests showing up. So it makes you wonder if these COVID tests are really just detecting a variant of the flu that is not COVID.
One of the biggest mysteries for people still living with is, why is Anthony Fauci and all the heads of the other health agencies refusing, so this entire time, to recommend early treatments whatsoever for symptomatic COVID positive cases, except to quarantine at home until they get so sick, and that could be 1 or 2 weeks, and then go to the hospital. And as you said, they don't have a big chance if they have comorbidities, depending upon how many comorbidities, and their age and their state of the immune system, to expect to come out of that hospital alive. And yet, since when did any physician that you know of turn away a patient who has early symptoms and say, no help at all, none at all? Well shouldn't I? What if I took hyperbaric oxygen? No, quackery. What if I just got oxygen at home? For $500, you can buy an oxygen, sit there and breathe it while you're working. Would that help? No. Vitamin C? I read some studies. In fact, there's a bunch of studies online in PubMed showing that astragalus helps with the no. What about olive leaf extract? I thought, no. So no vitamin, no. No diet, no. Losing weight, no. None of that's important. Can I go out and exercise? Well, I wouldn't. All right. That's exactly what was shared to hundreds of millions of people worldwide, still being shared in Australia and on Austria and the Netherlands. Since when is that an appropriate medical practice? In my opinion, that is malpractice and should be called for what it is, iatrogenesis, or medically induced or medical induced death and disease. Your thoughts, please.
Well, part of it, you know, I've been trying to figure out why physicians have responded the way they have. And it's multifactorial. Vitamins, I remember being trained in medical school that vitamins just made you, you know, you excrete very expensive urine. It was just a complete waste to take vitamins. That was part of my training. I had no training on preventative care, wellness, that sort of thing. In fact, it was sort of frowned upon that was alternative, fringy, you know, quackery, right? So that is part of it. It's the training. The other aspect is, and I have to admit, prior to the pandemic, I was of the same viewpoint, is that there's nothing you can do for a respiratory tract infection that's caused by a virus. Unless it's a flu, you could give Tamiflu. But other than that, you just go home and get better, which is understandable at the beginning of this pandemic. It is not excusable at this point in time, right? And it's all a matter of opening your mind and doing research. And, you know, I think the other aspect of this is how we got in this mess is physicians. You know, when I got out of residency, we were basically being squashed by the insurance companies. We didn't have any say in what we were compensated for visits, or in the insurance companies were dictating how much we get paid, when we got paid, what tests we could order, what medications we could order. And we were basically held hostage by insurance companies. In response to that, physicians banded together and grouped together into large groups. They let themselves be employed by large entities like hospitals that could help them barter against the insurance companies and protect themselves against the insurance companies. Well, now they're getting pushed around by these big hospitals that own them, or private equity groups that own them, or, you know, even if they're not owned, if it's physician owned, it's just the fact that they're all grouped together, they're all being told what they can do and what they can't do, and that has handcuffed them and muzzled them. So I am fortunate because I am solo practitioner. I don't take insurance. I have no third party ties. The only people I work for are my patients. So I can say what I think, and I don't have to have answer to a boss, and I don't have to worry about not getting, you know, being taken off an insurance plan. But there aren't enough of us out there like that.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. You worked at a hospital for a long time. Highly respected hospital, one of the most respected and prestigious hospitals in America. Was it your experience, or what was your experience, when it came to people being diagnosed or treated in ways that gave extra compensation because they were diagnosed with COVID versus maybe one of the underlying comorbidities they actually had? If someone came in with a heart attack or a stroke or end-stage emphysema from smoking and they tested on a faulty, and we now know, in fact, the CDC has discontinued the original PCR test, that they gave a disproportionate amount of false positives. In fact, the developer of the test, Dr. Carrie Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize in chemistry for the test, and someone I knew personally, and I filmed him. And in my film, which has gone viral, you can see it, and if you don't have it, I'll send you a copy. It's an hour and 54 minutes. He calls out Fauci repeatedly, wanting to debate to Fauci. Fauci wouldn't debate him. And in fact, he had arranged with the president of the University of South Carolina to have an open debate about how AIDS was being treated. Because once again, Fauci was saying no to any drug except AZT, which we now know is one of the most toxic drugs ever given, and it minimally killed 300,000 Americans, most of whom were asymptomatic, who became progressively sicker. And even when you look on the AZT label, one of the first things it says, side effects, AIDS. So you mean you couldn't distinguish whether a person was dying of HIV causing AIDS or AZT causing the symptom of AIDS, and that's correct. And from the humpback and the yeast and dementia and all the other conditions. And yet, Fauci would not even allow a drug that was known to help reverse pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, which was the number one killer for years of persons diagnosed with AIDS. He wouldn't backdoor him. He wouldn't recommend it. And that could have saved lives. And yet he was pushing vaccine, vaccine, vaccine. Wait till the vaccine, get the drug AZT in the interim. There's been over, I believe, over 100 vaccines tested for AIDS in over almost 40 years. None have worked, not one. That's Fauci. And yet Fauci was told and knew at that time that PCR should never be used for diagnosing an active infection like AIDS or any other condition, including COVID. And that's exactly how it was misused. And as a result of the amplification's at about a 43, even Fauci said that above 35, 36, they're all going to be junk. They're going to be, you know, false. They're just debris. And yet almost all Americans got that. Well, almost all the people in America got this faulty test and they tested positive. Think of what that does to you psychologically, thinking now you have something you can die from. And also think of what it does as far as early, the type of treatment you would have gotten versus what would happen if you were negative. It's mind-boggling that the scientific community and the media did not take this issue on and write about it and then discuss it, but they haven't. So that was a big issue. But at the same time, at the very beginning of this, the Chinese government opened up two studies using intravenous vitamin C, 24,000 milligrams of vitamin C. Not one of their patients that I'm aware of died. They also recommended vitamin D and vitamin C and zinc and antibiotics, as well as traditional Chinese medicine remedies, including what I had mentioned earlier, which was astragalus. So the main argument is that it was simply an operation of wait and delay until the vaccines or a novel drug for early treatment came along. That was their excuse. Wait, wait, wait. Oh, we do have one drug. Great drug. It's kind of a miracle drug. It's called remdesivir. And it was the only drug that was really used this whole time, still being used. And if you went into the hospital and you got into the ICU, there was a very high probability you were going to have two things. That drug, and who promoted the drug? One person, Anthony Fauci. And what was the clinical study on SARS-2, COVID-19? No, it was on a previous virus, and the Ebola virus. Okay, did you actually look at the study we have? It had a death rate of 56%, 54 to 56%, and they stopped the test. So the one drug that would kill up to 54 to 56% of people taking it, and it was stopped because of the high mortality rate, that's the drug that all American physicians were using in hospital, in the ICUs? Yes. Still using? Yes. Has anybody been called out on this crime against humanity? No one. Well, how do you know a person died of COVID versus dying of the side effects of the drug? They don't do that research. So when you look at this now and you see all these missteps, first, the hospital's charging and making a lot of money. And as you said, who owns most of the hospitals? Equity partners. These are great white sharks swimming looking for a nosebleed. These people will exploit anything and everything. These people are just, in my opinion, they're soulless. And so why doesn't the media, any of the media, do an expose on what happens when an equity partner buys your company, including your medical practice, where you no longer can determine what you're going to do as a physician and what is going to be charged? If you can make up to $100,000, and that's what we have now, you can make $100,000 by doing different procedures on a person diagnosed with COVID in a hospital, then versus what if they just came in for a regular condition, like a heart attack? Oh, that's a different amount, tremendously lower. So the gouging of profit, and these people are like a water glass that's overflowing, and it's still not enough to quench their economic thirst. So you see that. You see drugs that kill. Now, I should know something about this because five physicians, or PhDs, MDs and PhDs, myself included, we wrote the book, Death by Medicine. We sent 7,000 copies of it out. Not a single person reviewed it, not one. We only used their statistics showing the number one cause of death and injury each year in America was iatrogenesis, or medically induced. The American Journal of American Medical Association said it was third, but they didn't include bed sores. And you know how many people die of bed sores. And as you know, using holistic practices, no one should die of a bed sore. No one should have body ulcers. And also they didn't include infections inside the hospital or malnutrition. When you add those in, it's number one. In any case, and we're up to date on those figures, nobody even talks about that. So since no one's willing to open the door to see the truth of what goes on behind those, you know, behind those doors of profit-driven hospitals, shouldn't that also be a part of an open, honest, civil discourse? Your thoughts, please.
Right. The lack of transparency with the hospitals is a big issue with me. And prior to the pandemic, I was all about financial transparency in healthcare, because we've all been in that situation where we get this bill from after going to see the doctor or going to the hospital that makes no sense. You don't know if you're supposed to pay for it or just wait, and you don't understand why you're getting the charges. And it's a confusing mess. So when I set up my practice, I decided I'm not dealing with the insurance company aspect of it. All my prices are on my website, and this is what you pay. You can try to get reimbursed by your insurance company, but that's on your end. And I am a one of the chapter leaders of the Houston Free Market Medical Association, and they are all about transparency in healthcare. And I'm suing Methodist Hospital to get their financial data. And I wish more people would do this, because under the Freedom of Information Act, a nonprofit entity is required to show their financial data when asked. So I went and asked Houston Methodist for their financial data. I was completely ignored, and now I'm taking legal action. But we could explode this issue if we had people on board to do it, because it is, yeah, these nonprofit hospitals that are bankrupting Americans because they're not paying their bills. It would be a big story if somebody were willing to take it on.
A friend of mine went into an emergency room one night because he had upset stomach, and it didn't go away, right? And so he got in there. They put an ice pack on him, gave him a simple saline solution, and he got a $10,000 bill for it. $10,000 for spending a couple hours in a hospital, sitting there, and getting nothing, but the only thing he got was an ice pack and what cost the hospital probably a couple bucks, a saline solution. We're not even at a point where we can have a civil discussion about universal health care. The number one provider of health insurance in the United States just reported $24 billion in net profit. That's COVID. So they're exploiting it every way they can. Not a single investigation of them, no discussion of it. Okay, they make their money. Everybody's making the money, but who's saving the patients? It'd be one thing. I don't think anybody would care how much money you made as long as all your patients lived, right? I mean, if I have to go broke, but I'm going to be cured, not die, I'll go broke. But I don't want to end up taking treatments that actually exacerbate or cause my death and then be charged and my family charged and everyone else charged for that who is associated with it. That's just not ethical. Now, on that point, look at Dr. Pierre Kory. That's K-O-R-Y for those who don't know his name. What a courageous man. A great cardiologist, but also one of the best cardiologists and also one of the best kidney experts in the United States, publishing over 1,000 citations on PubMed, is Dr. Peter McCullough. Now, both people had all the credentials, just like yourself, multiple board certifications, published in peer-reviewed literature, respected in their, and not only respected in their field, but actually counseling governmental agencies, including the FDA, the World Health Organization. But the moment they found that there was a different way to take a repurposed, inexpensive drug, and by the way, talk about safety, show me a drug that's had over 4.5 billion doses used and is safe or safer than that, where you don't have the fatalities, and the couple fatalities you did have, both with hydroxychloroquine, is they weren't aware that hydroxychloroquine is cumulative. So if you gave 200 milligrams as a therapeutic dose 3 days a week, okay, at the end of the week, you've got 600 milligrams in your body. But in intensive care, they were giving high doses every day, and one of the patients got up to around, I think it was 10,000 milligrams, and he passed. Of course, you overprescribed, and that was wrong. Ivermectin, 3 milligrams a day prophylactically, you're not going to kill anyone. It's one of the safest drugs ever used. Both of these are safe compared to anything else that's been given. Well, McCullough and Kory both saw through early clinical experience, and McCullough especially with communicating with doctors in Italy and around the world who were engaged in early treatment and looking for answers and then sharing this information, which is legitimate. It's part of the FDA's own standard of information, clinical experience, and they leave that out everywhere. Journalists leave it out. Oh, yeah, we're attacking you because you used these therapies on 2,000 patients. But they're not asking you how the patients do. Are they alive and well? Yeah, none died. You were able to treat people on an outpatient basis that otherwise might have died in hospital? Yes. You stopped them from progressing? Yes. That means that you specifically should be bringing that information to the FDA and the CDC and Anthony Fauci and the World Health Organization as a clinician who's treated 2,000 patients and all survived. And you did it using repurposed drugs and nutrients and lifestyle modification, which is a reasonable and responsible way to help your patients. And yet you're attacked by the media. I read the article in the paper that attacked you. And all they had to do is simply confirm with you, do you have evidence to support your position? Instead, they're quoting people that you're not allowed to challenge. Well, why didn't you just say, why don't you all have a debate? If your purpose in calling me is to try to destroy me, then why don't you do it publicly? If you're going to execute me, don't put my hands behind my back and put a and tie them like a Chinese during the purge and, you know, shoot someone in the back of the head, which they did. No, let me have a chance to defend myself. I have yet to hear a single journalist, not one of the people at the New York Times, not one at the Washington Post, not one at the Atlantic Constitution or the Miami Herald or the Boston Globe or the San Francisco Chronicle or the Los Angeles Times, not one has invited people like yourself and the people like Dr. Corey or like Dr. Peter McCullough or Dr. Malone to come and debate. So if you're wrong, the public will see you're wrong. But you'll have a chance to defend yourself. You'll have a chance to present the clinical experiences, the patient records, the patients, the peer-reviewed literature supporting you, the independent scientific literature. And when they start to report, well, the Journal of the American Medical Association last week showed that, you know, ivermectin doesn't work. It doesn't? Then why don't you go through the actual study and see that what they're saying is that three people died who were on ivermectin, 10 people died who were on, it was reversed. The ivermectin, you only had 3 deaths. Those who didn't have the ivermectin had 10 deaths. That's a huge difference. So now we're seeing the corruption of science, corporate science. They're all doing this. They figured out, let's go to the Journal of the American Medical Association, the New England Journal of Medicine, the Lancet, because those are 3 we can put false information in and get away with it. And then we won't show the truth and we won't deconstruct it. But we did. And we found they're all fraudulent stories because what they say in the body, the statistics they show in the body of the article is not what they have in their conclusions. I used to teach a course in research methodology. And I can tell you that most people don't know how to read a study. And the average doctor's not going to read a study. You know that. They're too busy. And even the experts in the field don't always read in their own field. So it's easy to use propaganda to get in there. Well, who's got the power to get in there? Who's got the power to control what the New York Times says about 5G and make it praise it and not show the 10,000 studies showing what it can do, 5, 4, 3, and 2G and 1G plus Wi-Fi to the body? Then those studies are supported by thousands and thousands of research scientists working and who've put their reputation on the line saying 5G is bad. Nobody. They promote it. Well, how do you do that? How do you promote things that are known to be toxic? Well, let's see. Did we ever do that historically? Yes, cigarettes. They're good for you. They're good for your lungs. They're calming. No. DDT, hydroxychloroquine. Yeah. DDE, Agent Orange. And think of all the other things, copper coil 7, and think of the asbestos, PCBs. Think of all the things that we said were safe and effective. Think of the 52% of all drugs the FDA approved as safe and effective that had to be recalled because they were dangerous. What about all the patients that died when their doctors thought it was safe between when it was said it was safe and approved and when it was finally reverted back? So until someone's in the media is willing to explain to me how you missed every single one of these points with all your resources and all your contacts, then I want to know who behind the scenes talks to your news director and says, these are the talking points. Attack this woman. Attack this doctor. Attack these scientists. Call them quacks, charlatans, frauds, disinformation. Well, thank goodness for Cheryl Atkinson's latest post on Epoch News. And I'm going to show this, where she's a 5-time Emmy award-winning reporter. She can't be compromised. You can't separate the truth from her by bribing her or convincing her or threatening her. She's too strong. And she showed that all these fact-checking organizations are all controlled by major corporations. And they're all giving out misinformation, all of them. But you wouldn't know that reading the Houston papers, would you? Those are my thoughts. take any part of that, please, and share yours.
Right. Well, all these media outlets are owned by their advertising, by their advertisers. I mean, you watch CBS, NBC, ABC News at night. Every commercial is from a drug company. You look at the Houston Chronicle, they are in bed with Houston Methodist in terms of advertising. So there's a huge conflict of interest there. They're not going to bite the hand that feeds them. So how can they be objective? And yeah, in terms of the debate issue, that, I mean, I don't know if you know Steve Kirsch's. Yes. He is somebody that has been very outspoken and actually offered $1 million for anybody to come debate, to rise to the occasion, come debate, come do a public debate, and no one accepted it. There's a congressman in Houston that is very snarky about me and my thoughts on COVID. And he calls me out on Twitter, and I have asked him, I said, hey, let's do a debate. Let's do it on live TV. Let's get it all out there. You can show me your stuff and we can talk about it. Who won't do it? And that's very telling that no one's willing to come up and debate us, right? I mean, why is it, what do they have to lose if they are so correct in their stance? Why won't they say it out in public in front of everybody with a back and forth exchange? I think it says what it is, that they know that they would lose and that they would be ashamed. And I applaud Sanjay Gupta for going on Joe Rogan, but he looked pretty bad on it. And that's what they don't want to happen. They don't want to lose face. The narrative is crumbling. The truth is coming out, and they're retreating.
Their whole house of cards is falling. The lawsuits are commencing. And once these lawsuits gain traction and are not dismissed on summary judgment, they will win. And then all this will look, well, this will be the greatest medical catastrophe in American history. It'll be a shame upon the entire medical and scientific community and the government bureaucracies. But nobody will be held accountable. We held no one accountable for Vietnam, for Libya, for Syria, for weapons of mass destruction and in Iraq. So we're one of those unique positions where the people who make the mistakes are only criticized occasionally, and then they'll take someone and make them a sacrificial lamb. But everyone else, all the industries, all the profit made, nothing is ever done with that. My final issue is this. All the time I hear, well, Gary, I even read it in an email this morning. Gary, I believe that the science is showing that the vaccines are safe. And I wrote back, said, prove it. How can you say something is safe in the middle of a study where the study's not even half over yet? In the normal course of a vaccine study, and I've written 61 articles challenging vaccines, and all my articles never had to correct a sentence because I have it all methodically researched and all the footnotes there. And I simply ask them this. If the average vaccine takes between 5 to 7 years minimally to be tested, and we're still seeing side effects of it beginning, and then why, if anyone got side effects within the 14 days of getting a vaccine, they said that they were unvaccinated. And that had to be by intent. And then Dr. Rose, and I'm sure you're familiar with Dr. Rose's work, because she's also written with Dr. McCullough. She came on this program. And she said that looking carefully at the vaccine adverse event reporting system's own data, and then marking that Harvard University scientists said that only 1 to 2% of all vaccine adverse events and deaths are ever reported, because it's voluntary, it's not mandatory. And then interviewing dozens of people on this program, nurses and physicians, saying that, yeah, we saw people dying of side effects. They'd be completely healthy young people then ending up with myocarditis, endocarditis, etc. We didn't post any of that. In fact, one nurse said that nothing in the way of side effects was allowed to even be posted or they didn't have time, or it was too cumbersome, or it was complicated. And so then Harvard is probably correct. So she took a very conservative figure of 20%, and she came up with 100, and I believe her first figure was 167,000 deaths. But at a more realistic figure, it would have been around 600,000 deaths, she said. Columbia University came up with a study on its own, and it was also conservative, and it showed around 130,000+ deaths. But none of that made it into the media. Mind you, these were legitimate studies, but others have done studies showing side effects. Now, we have a more accurate appraisal from Europe, because it is mandatory in the yellow cards in England. And already you're up to over 2 million side effects, and a high percentage of those are permanent. You're up to a high level of deaths. And that is only, that's not all the countries, 27 countries in the European Union, it's only part of them. But just on that alone, go back to 1976 when 21 people had serious side effects and deaths from the vaccine at that time, swine flu vaccine, and they banned it. It was done. It was over. 40 million Americans had that. Now, as a percentage of the population getting a vaccine and the side effects and fatalities that caused it to be banned, that was terrific compared to the United States today, when you have far more people with side effects, far more deaths, even by the government's own statistics, were over 20,000 dead, by their statistics. Now, multiply that times whatever number you choose is realistic, and you're going to see that we've had more people die because of the vaccine side effects than American casualties in Vietnam times 3, or more casualties than the First World War American casualties. Surely someone in the media, someone in a governmental agency, someone at the FDA, someone at the CDC, someone in the Surgeon General's office say, you know something, compared to 1976, where they outlawed, they took it off the market at 20, it turned out they when they followed up, it was actually closer to 50 deaths. Here you have tens of thousands of deaths, over 1 million injuries, many lifetime, and not a single negative word about it? So how in the world can this person this morning who wrote me, oh, they're safe, how could you know it's safe if you haven't met and spoken with all these people, seen their medical records, talked with their doctors, talked with them? How about all the healthy athletes dying on soccer fields? These people don't die on soccer fields. When before COVID vaccines did you ever see any basketball player dying on a basketball court, football players dying, soccer players dying, swimmers dying in the height of their health? You don't. And yet, these are the people saying it's safe. And I'm saying, what do you think is going to be the case when we see the effects of compounding autoimmune conditions in people who already had a crisis in their autoimmune condition, getting vaccines on top of those conditions and virtually crushing their immune system and having organ failure, because there's only so many times you can go back to create antibodies when your body needs an antibody before you overwhelm it? Your final thoughts, please.
Right. I mean, it's inexcusable. We should have zero deaths from this vaccine. Zero is, I mean, we should, no person should be dying from this vaccine. It's absolutely unconscionable. And, you know, prior to the pandemic, I didn't know anybody that ever had a vaccine injury. Now I see somebody daily with a vaccine injury. And it's just unconscionable. And to be giving these to kids is just, it's dangerous. It should be, it's child abuse. I mean, it's astounding to me that this has been shoved under the rug the way it has. And it's speechless. I don't know. And the fact is too, that they're all protected. They're legally protected. You can't do anything about it. But I mean, all we can do is, you know, talk about it more and more. Hopefully people will start to listen and wake up and realize what is going on.
Finally, since it's not just a question and answer, I'm also giving my own opinion. If you've found any of my opinions to be inaccurate or unsupportable, please share with us now which of my statements you would offer challenge to.
No, I have no objections to anything you've said.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Mary Bowden, Bowden, and your website is what again?
BreatheMD.org.
BreatheMD, BreatheMD.org in Houston, Texas. Thank you for coming on this program. Continue to ask any journalist that contacts you. I'll only speak with you if you allow us to have a debate, you bring on the experts who are feeding you misinformation, and that I will also record that, and anything you write or broadcast must have my in-context information that is shared. And let's see how many journalists are willing to talk with you at that point.
Well, the journalists that don't agree with me don't ask me to talk to them, unfortunately.
That's the case, because let's face it. Imagine now, see, you do a little holistic practice, and I commend you on that. I'm going to send you some literature today, and hopefully you'll have a little time to look at it on articles I've written about COVID, but also on vaccines and their history. And there have been a lot of injuries throughout the years. It's just nobody wanted to pay attention to them. Mm-hmm. And it's time we started to look more carefully at what we're doing to our children and to ourselves. And I'm glad that you're out there, but you're not alone now. Not only do you have the frontline doctors, but you also have hundreds of thousands of scientists and physicians worldwide who are not going to be silenced. And they're rallying, and this is what we need, because my whole career, we've never seen this. We've never seen orthodox doctors and scientists challenging orthodox scientists and doctors. So this is good. This is a debate we've needed for a long time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for watching and listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day.